Start the new year in the right headspace with some great conversations. We've curated episodes on motivation, health, addiction, relationships, confidence, and mindset just for you.
Saying to myself, you've had a pretty good life, so not a bad way to die surfing. And then I thought, no, not today. You know, it's my family that brought it back.
Search Conversations Podcast with Richard Feidler and Sarah Kanoski on the ABC Listen app.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
The year is 1999 and 16-year-old Britney Spears is dressed as a schoolgirl with a starchy white shirt, necktie, and short skirt. Her hair is in two plaits and she's dancing for the camera, singing Hit Me Baby One More Time. Around the same time, movies like American Pie and American Beauty celebrated and fetishized the sexuality of teenage girls. And also teenage Sophie Gilbert was incubating her own understanding of love, sex, and gender roles, steeped, like a lot of us were, in this culture. One that taught girls and young women that their most valuable currency was to be appealing to boys and men. But it wasn't always like that. There had been trailblazing feminist ass-kickers smashing down doors and demanding to be taken seriously in the decades prior. So how did the decade from the 90s onwards so successfully blunt the energy of rebel girls and give us instead the Spice Girls? I want to bring you this conversation that was recorded in front of a live audience with Sophie Gilbert, who is now grown up and a staff writer for The Atlantic. She's the author of the award-winning book Girl on Girl, which looks at how the culture we consume shapes us. I'm Yumi Steins. Ladies, we need to talk about how pop culture turned a generation of women against themselves.
Can we please give a round of applause to Sophie Gilbert? All right, so I think the central premise of the book, let me lay it out to you and see what you think. By understanding all the ways that women have been diminished and broken down in the past, we can identify and defuse those same attacks in the present.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I started working on the proposal for the book after Roe v. Wade was overturned in the US, which was the decision that took away women's reproductive freedom. It just seemed like really tangible proof that things were not going well for women. And I wanted to know how we got there. In terms of how women feel about themselves and their ambitions and their desires, so much of what we know, how we feel about ourselves and each other, comes from popular culture. So it seemed really important to me to go back and look at this decade as an elder millennial, very elder, I should say. But I think the trickle-down effect has impacted every woman who's alive now in one way or another. And so much of the moment that we're living in now was informed by this decade.
Just to respond to that, the idea that we are shaped by our culture is very real, but it's hard to prove.
Yeah.
Do you find that in this work that people are like, yeah, but so what?
Not from women. I've not heard that from women. I think there's something really caught up in womanhood and the performance of it and the construction of it that it feels inherent to us, I think, to understand that we build ourselves from culture. We pick pieces of characters who we like, stories that we like, modes of being, the way that we dress. I mean, there's so much of that that is kind of taken and collaged from all the elements of things that surround us. So I have not heard that, but please do fight me after.
Can you tell us what some of your favourite influences were at the time?
Yeah, I mean, I remember so much the 2000s, just the aesthetic, like the very tanned, very these tiny, tiny orange bodies in Juicy Couture. And the big handbags, and everything was sparkly, everything was glitter. Just the aesthetic, I think, was really influential. But I also remember seeing movies like American Pie in real time and seeing the influence they had, less so on me and my group of friends, but very much on the boys that I knew who really seemed to take license from them to behave in certain ways.
Mm, you talk about that a lot in the book, American Pie.
Yeah.
Can we go deeper into that? So the film is about a group of boys who with girlfriends,
mm-hmm.
And the boys make a pact to lose their virginity by the end of school.
Yeah, they're in their senior year, which in America is the final year of school, and they're all virgins, and they're frustrated at that fact because they see losing their virginity as the final hurdle that it's in the way of their path towards, like, masculinity and manhood and adulthood. And I think the notorious scene now is the one where Jim, played by Jason Biggs, gets Nadia, a Czech exchange student, in his room. And for some reason, she takes off her clothes while he's not there and starts masturbating, and it's all broadcast without her knowledge or without her consent on a webcam that Jim has set up in his room. And there was really not much analysis of that aspect of things at the time. Whereas now, we're all like, this is non-consensual porn. But back at the time, it was kind of a big joke. And then the character of Nadia, she gets... she just kind of gets abruptly dismissed. She's expelled and you never see her again. That's kind of it.
So she's sort of exiled because of being hot and something happening to her that was absolutely not her fault.
Yeah. And the thing that was interesting to me about American Pie was how much that movie seemed to really license male sexual entitlement and how much it set up the girls in the film as the gatekeepers. They're given all the authority over making this decision, whether or not they sleep with these boys. But in doing so, what happens is they lose all sense of their own choice, really, their own desire. Like, what do they want? It doesn't matter. The only thing that matters is they're standing in the way of what the boys want, and they bear the weight of that, I think.
And you said you saw the influence of that on the males in your life.
Yeah, I mean, I knew a lot of very juvenile 17-year-old boys, and they loved that movie, and they they seemed to take that message, I think, of sexual entitlement to heart. And you could just see, you could see the impact among the girls who I knew and who had boyfriends. There was a lot more pressure, I think, to help the boys get what they wanted.
Wow, that's a lot, isn't it? And if you extrapolate that across all the culture that we're imbibing at the time and its influence on people.
Yeah, but even the indirect influence, I wanted to trace not a direct path, because nothing, I think, in culture is ever really directly connected. Everything is much more diffuse. And influence, I would say, is more important a word than connection. But I do trace a line from American Pie to the so-called incel movement of the 2010s, because there was an incel killer called Elliot Rodger who murdered 6 people. Involuntarily celibate. But Elliot Rodger left a 110-page manifesto in which it's basically a list of all the movies and TV shows he watched that taught him that his adult life would be full of carefree sex and women giving him what he wanted. And so it seemed important, I think, to like glimpse that culture and think about the influence that it had on certain kinds of young men.
It's so interesting because in that particular story, a writer that you cite in your book called out Judd Apatow and Seth Rogen for one of the movies that this Elliot Rodger talked about and quoted as an influence in him. And the pushback was so vicious from these two, you know, those two nice guy directors, and they make these rom-coms that center men and they seem like inoffensive guys, and yet they really lashed out at this idea.
They did. It was a very defensive reaction. And they also lashed out, even before that, they lashed out in 2007 when Katherine Heigl, who obviously is the star of the movie Knocked Up, gave an interview to Vanity Fair in which she described Knocked Up as a little bit sexist, which I think is generous, honestly. But there was a huge pushback to that, and her career really suffered. And I think what was interesting to me about that was, why was the misogyny of this decade so normalized? Like, why didn't we push back? And I think part of the answer is, in the moments when we did, there was such a ferocious response. It just wasn't worth it.
Now, there's a couple of other women that you said came up repeatedly in your research throughout the decades in many different ways. Demi Moore mm-hmm. and Kate Moss. Can you talk us through, maybe start with Demi Moore?
Yeah, Demi Moore, she's someone who just seemed to visibly embody trends in womanhood like few other people did. She was obviously the first person to be pregnant and nude on a magazine cover, in this groundbreaking Vanity Fair cover in the early 90s that really changed public perceptions of pregnancy and of womanhood. And it was, I think we can all see it now in our heads, and it's a gorgeous cover, but it was so controversial at the time. In some stores, it had to be sold wrapped in brown paper bag, like a porn mag. She at one point was the highest paid actor in Hollywood for the movie G.I. Jane. And she, because she was well paid, she got a reputation for being grasping. Her nickname was Gimme More. Oh. And then she left acting, actually, in a moment when the percentage of women in the American workforce was starting to decline for the first time, to raise her family on a farm in Idaho, I think.
And the other thing is about that pregnant picture that Annie Leibovitz took, that wasn't completely consensual either, the publication.
No, it wasn't supposed to be the cover. Initially, she posed clothed, I think, but she asked Annie Leibovitz to take nude pictures for her and her husband, Bruce Willis, as a memento of the pregnancy. And then somehow Tina Brown, who was editor of Vanity Fair at the time, saw them and was convinced that they had to go on the cover. So I think did get Demi's consent, but it wasn't initially the plan for how the shoot was supposed to go.
Mm. And as you emphasise, Demi had a set idea of what the how the thing would go, but then was sort of ushered, yeah. Which is a polite way of saying coerced. So potentially she was very, very compliant and was really into it, and it was a huge success. It was a groundbreaking moment, but it was not what the boundary that she had set initially at all.
Yeah, and you mentioned Kate Moss as well. I mean, Kate Moss, her first photo shoot when she was 16 years old for The Face magazine, that very famous Summer of Love cover, and she's nude in that at 16, and she has later said that she was really bullied by the photographer into taking her top off. She did not want to be naked in those pictures, but the photographer was convinced that they would be iconic images, and they are, but you know, at what cost?
Mm.
I mean, when you're 16, you don't know how to stand up for yourself. Mm. You don't know what the conditions should be or where the line is. You don't know any boundaries.
In my podcast, Ladies, We Need to Talk, Kate Moss often comes up when people talk about the start of an eating disorder.
Interesting.
Mm.
Interesting. Over the course of talking about this book, a lot of people have described the moment when the Baby One More Time video came out as the moment when their childhood ended. Which is, I'm laughing, but it's really sad.
What do they mean their childhood ended?
It was just the end of a certain kind of period of teenage innocence, I think.
Hmm.
And it was the moment when suddenly, I guess that when I think about the artists that I loved during the 90s, I was such a big Spice Girls fan. And the Spice Girls always seemed to be performing to girls my age, to 13-year-olds. They really behave like toddlers at a wedding, like they run around, they throw food on the floor. They weren't performing for men, I don't think. They weren't performing for the male gaze. And then when you see someone like Britney come along, and I'm not sure that she knowingly was either, but it was pitched slightly differently and the tenor was such that it seemed to be performing a certain kind of sexuality in a way that the Spice Girls never had.
Tell us how you feel now to see the way that somebody who was literally 16 years old is sexualized in that overt way for the consumption of everybody, not just men, but I mean, kids were watching this as well.
It's really weird to go back and watch it. The way that she's dancing is the thing I get stuck on because she's really grinding her hips in a way that it's quite strange to see a 16-year-old do and remember the context of her youth at the time. And also, I think so much of what she was sold as and what she was performing was this real mix of sexuality and purity. Mm. And so it was a kind of balance of conflicting versions of womanhood that is very hard to pull off. But when you can do it, I think it's incredibly popular in culture. The fact that people, you know, housewives loved her because they thought she was waiting for marriage, but also, you know, men were watching that video for different reasons, but it's an impossible tightrope to walk for a meaningful amount of time, I think.
Well, time is crucial because you're going to grow out of it, aren't you? And just to think about the parameters of virginal but sexy,
yeah,
and young, plausibly virginal and sexy, like how many people can fit inside of that?
And it's a trap because it gives you no space to really live. It gives you no space to figure out sexuality for yourself or to think about what you want because you're stuck in this incredibly narrow, incredibly constrictive box.
I just want to talk about some of the artists that preceded the Britney and Spice Girls era. Mm. You mentioned some already. Sonic Youth had Swimsuit Issue. Tori Amos had Cornflake Girl. Hole was singing Miss World. Juliana Hatfield, Supermodel. PJ Harvey, the song Dress. No Doubt, Just a Girl. Alanis Morissette, of course, Jagged Little Pill. So you had all these women with teeth, claws, muscles and attitude.
Mm-hmm.
Fierce, and popular. So how did mass culture blunt their power and then replace them with these dollies?
I think the music industry, to some extent, was always fighting them. Like, it would put those women on. There was a magazine cover, I think, Tori Amos and Alanis were on, and the headline was Lips, Hips, Tits, Power. Which, wow. These women, they were not taken seriously. They were not given the credit that they deserved, but they had huge fan bases because their music was incredible. But then the Spice Girls came along, and I think what they did, they were so incredibly successful. They had $500 million worth of branding and commercial deals in their first year and a half as a band, and which was a huge amount. Like, they had... And I don't think it had been really done before because this was the sellout 90s. Someone told me at a book event they had a Spice Girls toaster. There were Spice Girls Polaroid cameras. Anything you could buy a Spice Girls version of it. And once people figured out that teenage girls were a very lucrative demographic, that was it. There was no space for women in rock anymore. All people wanted was sexy teenagers who could sell lip gloss and toasters.
Can you help us understand how girl power, as a phrase, got appropriated?
Yeah, so girl power as a slogan was initially popularized by two members of Bikini Kill, the Riot Girl punk band, Kathleen Hanna and Toby Vail. And I think Toby said, what's a word that doesn't go with girl? They were looking for two words that no one would put together. And Kathleen said, power. So the pairing of girl and power was supposed to stop and make you think. It was supposed to make you realize, like, why don't we associate girls with power? What does that mean? Why has that always been the way? So whenever they would shout girl power, it was this very activist slogan and it had all this intention behind it. And then the Spice Girls came along and they appropriated girl power and popularized it in a huge way. But they didn't have any of that activism. It was just celebratory. It was like, girl power, we're in charge now. Girls, like, we can do anything we want. We are free. We can live however we want. We can spend however much money we want. We can sleep with whomever we want, in a way that really seemed to be reflecting the rise of post-feminism and the reaction to feminism, in a sense that people thought it was no longer necessary. They thought that the 2000s would be all about freedom and fun and celebration.
And individualism?
And individualism, yeah.
So it wasn't about girl power, let's lobby for better abortion rights or...
No.
Or, childcare.
Yeah, or, yeah.
It was give me that Spice Girls body spray.
Yeah.
Yeah. One of the things that you talk about is the way that this idea was sold to girls and women, and I completely remember this myself, self-objectification is empowerment.
Yeah, I mean, empowerment is a word that kept coming up in my research, inevitably in a defensive context. So something sexist would happen, like the Wonder Bra ads with Eva Herzegova that supposedly caused car crashes because her boobs were like 6 feet across. But they were very like old-fashioned bombshell imagery, a woman in a bra and she's like, hello, boys. But the defense of those ads was that they were empowering, that Wonder Bras were empowering. And this word just kept coming up. And it just seems to be whenever it comes up, it's being used not to justify anything that actually gives women power, but to sell women a very sexualized vision of themselves that might give them power if they perform it the right way.
Right. I just really want to sit with self-objectification as empowerment for a minute, because a lot of what you talk about is the pornification of mainstream culture, mm-hmm. and then the natural impulse for people to imitate what they see. So can you help us understand how self-objectification became a form of self-expression, a really mainstream form of self-expression, particularly for young girls?
Yeah, I think around the 2000s, there were a lot of things that happened at the same time. Obviously, the internet was becoming more and more of a force in people's everyday lives. And there were blogs popping up everywhere that were thriving on pictures of women. So you got just coverage of famous women doing things all the time. But the 2000s were also the era that saw the beginning of reality television. And before reality television, I think if you were famous, you were probably famous for a reason. You had a talent, you had a skill, you were an actor, you were in sports. But reality television came along and suddenly all you needed to do to be famous as a woman was to be visible enough to trade your privacy for visibility. And I think seeing that over and over and over again, we did start to absorb that if we maybe could be visible enough, it seemed like it might be accessible for us even, because suddenly normal people were becoming famous.
Mm. And what's fascinating about that is how often it was non-consensual with even those famous people. The Pamela Anderson sex tapes, Paris Hilton sex tapes, they were non-consensually leaked.
Yeah.
Tell me what you think our culture got from seeing Pamela Anderson try and fight the release of those tapes and the publication and the dissemination of that sex tape with Tommy Lee, her then husband, and fail.
I think what was really devastating about what happened to Pamela, she made a tape with her husband on her honeymoon, and it was kept in a safe in her home, and an angry contractor who I think Tommy Lee had stiffed on a job at their house stole the safe, thinking it would contain money, found the tape, and obviously released it, propagated it. And this was in 1996. So again, like early days of the internet. And Pamela Anderson tried to push back, and her lawyers told her that because she'd previously posed for Playboy, she didn't have a case to stand on because it was deemed that she'd already like exposed herself in a sexual capacity anyway. But she was also persuaded to license the video to an internet streaming company because she thought that would be the quickest way, I think, to stop it being sold in tapes. And she didn't understand that what she was doing was basically allowing, like opening it up to the entire world. I think just because there was a real lack of comprehension about what the internet was at the time. Mm. And there was a real sense that if you were famous, that you no longer had the right to complain about however your image was used, even if it was stolen material, even if it was in some ways deeply humiliating.
Mm. There was a lot of extreme cruelty in the treatment of women who were in the public eye. I think Britney Spears is a really good example. It's breathtaking now when we look at how she was vilified and just mocked, and at such a young age. I'm thinking about when she'd had children, so she was an adult, but she was also a very vulnerable young woman.
Yeah.
and barely an adult. Do you think, first of all, that we are better now?
I do. And this was one of the foundational reasons of wanting to write the book for me, because I remembered that head shaving moment so well. And I remembered acting like it was soap opera, almost like it was entertainment, not understanding in any way that this was a woman who had had two kids before the age of 25, who was in a horrible custody battle with her husband and wasn't being allowed to see her children, who had been famous since she was 16, which is really long before, because she was on the Mickey Mouse show when she was a child. Not understanding any of the dynamics of that because of the way in which it was being presented. And the tone of the internet at the time was just astonishingly cruel. And I've been trying to reason why it was, and I do think it was a reaction to the kind of fame that these women had and the ways in which suddenly their image was everywhere. And I think you see it a lot now with people like Kim Kardashian, for example. Like they're so overexposed, they're so famous that people get resentful. And especially they do get resentful as well if they feel like these women are not living up to the terms, the conditions of their fame, if they're failing in some way, if they're not performing, you know, the flawless, beautiful performance of celebrity that we like to watch.
Mm. Just back to the idea of feeling resentful because the celebrity hasn't lived up to the terms and conditions. What sort of terms and conditions is that to be perfect at all times?
Yeah, I think people felt that the deal was that if these women were going to be everywhere, then they needed to at least live up to that portion of things. If they weren't going to be, you know, acting or singing, I mean, Britney was a singer, but at that point she was better known as a kind of paparazzi target, I think. It was just this non-stop rolling soap opera of people having breakdowns in the public eye. Mm. And obviously in response to what the conditions that they were living under, which was being stalked nonstop by paparazzi, which is incredibly stressful, incredibly invasive, having people jump in front of your car, having people try to provoke traffic accidents, having people lie down on the street to try and take pictures of you without underwear, to try and take pictures of your skirt. Like now, of course, we would say this is monstrous. I think we would understand and we have a better sense of mental health, and we're more empathetic, I think, not always and not in certain factions of the internet, but generally as women, I think we are much more empathetic as consumers of media.
I want to talk about porn, even though it upsets me and it makes me feel icky and it distresses me, but what we saw in this era of the 90s was porn having to kind of become more extreme as its imagery was co-opted by fashion and the mainstream. Porn had to, I guess, pivot, for want of a better word, to remain relevant. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, culture got very sexy in the 90s. Partly, interestingly, as a response to the AIDS crisis, which had, you know, we had this moment of sexual liberation in the 70s, a sort of movement away from stigmatizing and shaming of sex. And then AIDS came along and suddenly everyone was terrified and anxious, and that stigma and shame came back. And culture, I think, divided into two factions. And one was very traditionalist. And then the other faction was very sexual in a way that I think was really playing up to voyeuristic instincts. And the idea was that post-AIDS, if you couldn't have sex, you could watch sex, like you could look at sex. And as culture got sexier and sexier and sexier, porn was also becoming more and more popular because of VHS technology, because of the internet. But porn by its nature is transgressive. It can't be doing the same thing as mainstream media. So in order to keep people paying for it, in order to keep, you know, its raison d'etre, it had to become more extreme. And so you do see this real shift towards the end of the 90s into more extremity in porn and more, especially a lot more aggression and violence towards women.
And it's really worth talking about. And I know it's an uncomfortable conversation, but to settle into it for a second, because if porn imagery is infiltrating mainstream culture and we've kind of agreed that we are influenced by what we see in movies, TV, if we're watching porn in that as well, then how is that going to affect people, particularly those who maybe aren't sexually experienced and are doing stuff for the first time, but also just the population at large? Do you talk about how people who drank that Kool-Aid or are drinking it have been affected?
Yeah, there's a statistic in the book. I think 38% of women aged 18 to 34 in one recent study said that they'd been non-consensually choked during sex, or they'd had some kind of non-consensual violent act, spitting, hitting, punching, choking. So people learn what sex is through porn, especially boys. But also, I think just the power dynamics, for the most part, these are products that are made for men and that very much gratify a male understanding of sexuality. I think like the term money shot, for example, everything that is prioritized in porn is this very visible evidence of male gratification. It's the most crucial thing, the most crucial component in some ways. And the power dynamics of that, there's no way that they haven't filtered into the ways that we all think about love and sex and dating and each other.
And what we see in mainstream movies as well.
I know that you interviewed Monica Lewinsky just a month ago. Can you tell us about that experience and how it's made you reflect on the progress that we've made?
Yeah, I interviewed Monica at the Atlantic Festival in New York in September. And I have been for a long time astonished by her grace, by her courage, by her, and her just incredible thoughtfulness about the dynamics of what happened to her and her, I think grace is the right word, but she was someone who was really relentlessly mocked, pilloried, fat-shamed, slut-shamed. I think Kid Rock at Woodstock 99 got on stage and said, Bill Clinton is a goddamn pimp and Monica Lewinsky is a fucking hoe. Like, this was a woman who was very young, who had obviously been in a situation where the power dynamics were completely unequal, the most powerful man in the world. She was an intern. But in 2014, after a period of relative silence, I think, where she had tried to live a normal life, she went to graduate school in London. She assumed at some point that she would just be able to get a job and move on, and then realized that she just could not. She could not. She would go to job interviews and people would kind of go, she'd had her livelihood taken away in lots of ways. Like, there was no capacity for her to claim her normal life back. And I think when she realized that, she decided that instead she would stand up to show people that you could survive public shaming. And so she wrote this Vanity Fair article in which she really critically and rigorously laid out what had happened to her and especially how feminists had responded in their failures in terms of standing up for a woman. And it was this incredibly powerful moment because we're sort of used now, I think, to the idea that we're in a moment of historical revisionism with women, you know, the documentary framing Britney Spears and the movies about Tonya Harding and all the willingness that we have to go back and look at women who were incredibly unfairly treated in the media and to try to revisit that treatment in ways that can't quite make amends, but to sort of go back and look at things differently. And she was the person who kicked off that moment. I think when she stood up and she really insisted that people see, again, the fullness of her story, the complexity of it, and to see her as a human being and not as this caricature in media. And I think the impact that it's had has been incredible. So all credit to her.
Can we please give a round of applause to Sophie Gilbert?
Thank you so much. Thank you all so much for coming, and thank you, Yumi. This was wonderful.
This podcast was produced on the lands of the Gundungurra, Gadigal and Muwinina peoples. Ladies We Need to Talk is mixed by Anne-Marie de Bettencourt, produced by Elsa Silberstein and Sarah Mashman. Supervising producer is Tamar Cranswick, and our executive producer is Alex Lolbach. This series was created by Claudine Ryan.